with 14 points. Kamari McGee with 11, 8 for Max Klusman. He also had 7 rebounds and 3 assists today. Jack Janicki with 7 points, really doing some work in the first half on a steal and a dunk that got the crowd going. Nolan Winter with 6 points and 7 rebounds. Let's go down the line here. Carter Gilmore, 3 points and 4 boards. Marcus Silver, a couple of points. Ricardo Greppi getting his first bucket as a Badger. He had 4 free throws earlier this season, but got back on the floor late in the game, got himself a dunk. Xavier Amos with 2 points today. Stephen Crowell with 1 point. No field goal attempts officially for him. Got his 1 point at the free throw line. Had 7 rebounds and 3 assists in the game. Bryce Williams with 11, pacing Nebraska here today. Connor Asijan ends up with 8 points, 3 of 10 from the field, 2 of 7 from the 3-point line. Berka Buchtingel with 7 for the Huskers. Raleigh Wooster with 7. Sam Hoiberg with 6. Andrew Morgan with 5. Aaron Euless ends up with 3. Jeffrey Grace for the Huskers gets a couple of points late. Cale Jacobson with 1. Juwan Gary with but 5 points in this game. Gary averaging 12.5 per. So as we mentioned during the game, the top scorers really held in check today by this Wisconsin defense. Badgers winning at 83-55 over the Huskers. More to come as our Wisconsin Ford Dealers postgame show continues. This is Badger Basketball from Learfield.
Join the Wisconsin Department of Corrections and make a positive impact on lives across the state. Enjoy an excellent state benefits package and a nationally ranked pension program. The Wisconsin DOC is currently hiring correctional officers with a starting pay of over $33 per hour, plus scheduled increases and plenty of advancement opportunities. Plus, hourly rates increase for those hired for medium and maximum security positions. To learn more and apply, go to wisc.jobs. That's WISC.jobs.
Coors Light presents To Chill or Not to Chill. When your friend skips your favorite song on the playlist. End the friendship. Or choose chill because that song lives rent-free in your head anyway. And you planned ahead by bringing Coors Light to the party. And the sound of that ice-cold can cracking open was music to your ears already. Coors Light. Choose chill. Celebrate responsibly. 2024 Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Let's have brats for dinner.
Whoa, maybe not.
Hi, this is Fritz Usinger. Your home freezer can begin to suck moisture and flavor out of improperly packaged food products within a matter of days. That's why at Usinger's, we flash freeze our brats and then vacuum seal them to lock in flavor and seal out air. Just put them in your freezer, and when you're ready for a Usinger brat, drop the package in a bowl of water, and in 15 minutes, they're ready to grill. Remember, if it has an elf on the label, you've got quality on your table.
Are you seeking a better career? Rail Transport offers truck drivers a variety of driving jobs earning top wages. No CDL? No problem. Get paid to get your CDL with Rail's on-the-job paid training program. We're also seeking top talent for driver and customer support positions. To see all the career opportunities at Rail and how you can take home more and be home more, visit rail.jobs. That's rail.jobs. Rail Transport is a proud sponsor of the Badgers.
An elegant, intimate experience in fine dining is right here at Ho-Chunk Gaming, Wisconsin Dells. The Copper Oak Steakhouse and Lounge features choice cuts of Angus beef and fresh seafood prepared to perfection over an open flame grill, complemented by an extensive selection of fine wines and signature martinis. A passion for detail in exceptional dining. The Copper Oak Steakhouse and Lounge at Ho-Chunk Gaming, Wisconsin Dells. Open Thursday through Sunday. Call and make your reservations today.
We believe in education. We believe in public schools. At WEA Member Benefits, we believe in helping Wisconsin public school employees and their families achieve their financial goals by providing personal insurance, retirement and investment, and financial planning programs that are designed specifically for the education community. WEABenefits.com. That's WEABenefits.com. WEA Member Benefits is a proud partner of Wisconsin Athletics.
Badgers hit the road. Couple of games coming up this week. 6 o'clock tip Central Time on Wednesday at Maryland, and then Saturday afternoon in Evanston against Northwestern. That game will start at 1 o'clock. Badgers defeating Nebraska here today, 83 to 55 as we are joined courtside by head coach Greg Gard, who I guess I've known long enough, much like his predecessor. Yeah, they scored 83 points, but I want to guess you want to talk about your defense maybe.
Much better today, wasn't it, guys?
It was
much
better. We were talking during the game. Butchie brought up the point, though. I know Tuesday was what Tuesday was, but you guys have been on a pretty good path of that in the floor, haven't you?
We have been. You know, I think that comes with time and repetition and work and guys taking ownership in it. And today they took complete ownership in it. It was the challenge before the game. And, you know, because we're top 10 in the country offensively. And so that makes us really good. We want to be elite. We got to get to be in top 25 defensively. We're not. We're in the 50s somewhere. So that was the challenge of where we need to get to, where we want this program to be. And, you know, we had a preseason target of top 10 in offense, and we are. I think we were hovering at 9 after yesterday yesterday. And now defensively, some of it's how, you know, we don't have a legit shot blocker. We don't have Brian Butch back there protecting the rim and, you know, swatting
those words
stuff.
Were never said,
swatting off. He wasn't allowed to block shot chest up, right, Brian? Take a charge.
Even if I was allowed, it wouldn't have happened either.
I thought defensively we made life pretty hard for the most part. A little flurry there at the end of the first half that we shot, you know, too quickly at the end of the half to give them another possession. But all in all, a really good team effort.
Did you think you were elite? Because that's actually the word I used. I used it during the game first half. I said, right now this team defensively is playing elite defense. And that's the step. I thought you were. I thought you guys guarded as five. Right. You sprayed out when you needed to. You fouled the scouting report. Guys that were shooters, you got to. Guys that weren't. There was a little bit of a space. Like,
John Tanjay in October didn't understand what gap help was. Today he was plugging gaps.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
And in the right spot. I mean, it's just, like I said, it's credit to him and it's credit to others. I mean, whether you're in your sixth year or your first 6 months, you have to continue to learn and get better. He was obvious because he was right in front of me in that first half with plugging up dribble drive stuff and knowing he could, you know, didn't have to get immediately back to a shooter. And it changes from game to game. There's some games you can't do that as frequently. But I thought really a tremendous defensive effort.
There's a lot of other guys I could point out, but it seemed like Jack Janicki did some work for you, especially in the first half.
Oh, yeah.
That was a big time, wasn't
it? Yeah, Klez kind of tweaked his ankle there, and I just, you know, Jack got in, and, you know, he gets going. You know, I think it just his minutes have been so inconsistent, and that's part my fault, part just competition of him to get in a rhythm. It's hard when you're a freshman and you're inconsistently playing. But I thought he really locked in defensively. He's a terrific athlete. He really moves. He's got some toughness to him. And it was good to see him, you know, knock down that three because he's been working a lot on it, and he's had some good looks, and he's probably a better shooter than what his numbers indicate. And it was, like I said, even Big Grep gave us some good minutes there.
Yeah, sure did. Steve only gives you 1 point. But in the way and I brought that up. I said, even though it's 1 point, you look at 7 rebounds.
Yeah.
Because the way Nebraska guards it with the double team right away. Like,
that was actually
selfish.
The starting point.
Like,
exactly.
He'd be selfish if he tried to make a move.
And then we'll play 4-on-3 everywhere else. Yep. And, you know, he only has 3 assists. But if this was hockey,
I was just going to
then he'd have a lot more.
Absolutely.
And so that was the whole point. Throw it to him. Yep. Let him come and double team, and let's make good decisions. We can't throw the Hail Marys to the other side of the floor. Let's you know, take the shorter route. Don't have to throw it 60 yards when you can throw the 10-yard out and make better decisions out of it. And, you know, obviously he really helped facilitate that.
You mentioned Max a couple of minutes ago about they tweaked an ankle, and he's had some tough luck, you know, with the health stuff in the last couple of weeks and getting that confidence. He makes a three, and then he's looking up into the heavens. If I'm an opponent, he scares me to death right now because he could get on these rolls where we've seen these heaters before. It just seems like with him it's a matter of time.
Yeah, and it's a matter of, you know, it's contagious, it's confidence, it's, you know, you see one or two go in or you see a teammate make one or two and all of a sudden, like we started the game, you know, it's a barrage.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, his, you know, I think him defensively really set the tone. He's vocal, he's physical, and we know he'll make shots and take the right ones and those type of things. So, yeah, I mean, it's – and the nice part about this team is that we're not dependent on – we can spread it around and have a lot of versatility.
And nobody cares.
Yeah. That's a beautiful thing.
I mean,
18
assists on 30 buckets, 18 assists, 8 turnovers. You know, it was a very unselfish effort.
Last thing I got for you, you got a pair of shoes on.
Yeah.
They brought a bunch of kids out during the game.
Yeah, the media, 12-minute media.
Yeah, 12-minute media. You had a great, that was up on the Jumbotron and Kirk was talking. You had two guys over here that were in tears trying to call a game, which couldn't get a lot of words out.
Right.
You do have a platform. And what you guys have done, you guys went to the Children's Hospital and had them color and draw on the shoes.
Right.
As a dad that's going through some stuff myself, first of all, thank you. Because it means more than what people know.
Right.
And then obviously recognizing the kids, it was awesome. But with your platform and what you're doing, what did that mean to your players? Because I remember doing the stuff with Bo,
right?
With you guys. And, we just did it because we did it.
Right.
And then it hits you personally. And you just,
Yeah.
And it was a lot.
You know, I think what I've tried to do, Brian, is, I went through it. You went through it with your mom. She was able to battle it when you were here and beat it. I went through it with my dad and didn't have as good an outcome. So what I've tried to do is use my personal experiences to help educate our team, meaning I tell them my story or I tell them other people's story and just try to give them real-life perspective. And I said, every time you have a hard day, just come with me and we'll go sit at the valet at the hospital, Children's Hospital, VA, doesn't matter. Let's just watch. And you think you're having it hard? No, this is really easy to fly around, play basketball, and eat food and all that stuff. Go to school, and we're paying for all of it, and you're getting paid. It's just perspective. It's a credit to our players because Coach Krabanoff has a great saying that in the recruiting process, we do really well with good people. I mean, they turn into really good players. They're great community members. They have great success here on and off the court. And really good people have that perspective of this is bigger than yourself. You know, the last thing you need to have here is an ego that thinks that you are the center focus. No, this is all bigger than us. And I think that experience taking the kids to the Children's Hospital, they knew. But they dove right in, man. They're sitting bedside with those kids. Same thing when we went to LA last week and we were doing the food bank stuff. It's just, we have really good people and our fans all see them or listen to you guys call and they run around in the jerseys and they think they're just kids, they're young adults, but they're on the right track in life. And it's our job to, help them through the good and show them some bad too. Like, hey, you might be a parent, in a situation or you might have somebody, I think it's just our obligation to be able to help lift other people up.
Yeah, it was a powerful moment, I'll say that. And on a lighter note, Butchie, as neither of us could talk there for a couple of minutes, I think some would view that as peak broadcasting on our part, too.
Very so true. Absolutely.
But it was, congratulations on this and, for everything that you and Michelle do for guarding against cancer. And give yourself a couple hours to enjoy this one, and we'll see you in Maryland.
We got Eagles or Commanders or Chiefs or Bills. What do we – since our Packers aren't in it.
I've got the other – at our station, there's a couple of, Chiefs haters, so therefore go Chiefs, I'll say.
Yes. And
Eagles, I think. Eagles? I saw Bo Allen, the former Eagle, former couple of different teams. He had a great post. He's at the game today. So because of Bo's connection there, he won a ring there a few years ago.
Okay.
So give me Eagles, Chiefs.
He also did have Aaron Andrews and
Carissa
Thompson around both arms. So he's living a good life.
Bo Allen. What do you got? Who do you got?
Well, I'm sure I checked my phone.
I was going to say, how's the other Bo?
Eagles fly text I had a week ago.
That's true.
I haven't checked with him lately. I'm sure I left him alone after the Eagles doinked the Packers.
That was a good smart choice.
He didn't rub it in. He didn't throw any salt in the wound.
I was going to say it kept him off the golf course, but he's probably already played his.
He's got it for sure.
He's already played. Yeah. He'll be tuned in.
Yeah. Well, go relax and enjoy those. Enjoy the game.
Get ready for the Terrapins.
There you go.
All right. Thanks, Coach.
Badgers head coach Greg Gard joining us. Wisconsin 83, Nebraska 55. Back to close it off in 1 minute. This is Badger basketball from Learfield.
Smokey the Bear.
Then you know why Smokey tells you when he sees you passing through. Remember, please be careful, it's the least that you can do.
Don't play with matches, don't play with fire. After 80 years of learning his wildfire prevention tips, Smokey Bear lives within us all. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com. And remember,
only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Sports allow us to play, learn, and grow. But there's something more important than victory. At the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, we believe every athlete deserves to be safe. Safe from abuse and misconduct on and off the field. We equip athletes, parents, coaches, and others with the right education to recognize, prevent, and respond to harmful behavior. Join the movement to champion respect and end abuse at uscenterforsafesport.org.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. On Monday, January 20th, Donald Trump returned to office, sworn in as the 47th president of the United States. Right out of the gate, he took a number of actions on his top issue, immigration. Perhaps the most troubling of these is one aiming to end birthright citizenship in America. An immigration attorney I talked to told me, "We're going to sit through a lot of BS over the course of the next weeks, months, and years, but this is the big one." My take? This action from the Trump administration is despicable, unconstitutional, and fundamentally anti-American. The day after the order was issued, Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call joined a coalition of 20 states challenging this action in court. This legal battle will be a tremendously important one for all of us to follow.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information, and WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
Haven't checked him out. Do so as soon as you can. Next home game for Wisconsin, by the way, will be February 4th against Indiana. That'll do it for us as Wisconsin defeats Nebraska here today, 83-55. This broadcast is a copyrighted presentation of Badger Sports Properties, a property of Learfield, under the broadcasting rights granted by the University of Wisconsin. Rebroadcast or reuse of this presentation is prohibited without the express written consent of the University of Wisconsin and Badger Sports Properties. The announcers are employed by the Badger Network with the approval of the University of Wisconsin. The general manager of Badger Sports Properties is Scott Silvestri. For Brian Butch, our engineer Dave McCann, and Aisha Jackson back at our studio, this is Matt LePay, hoping you'll join us on Wednesday night as the Badgers take on the Maryland Terrapins. Thanks for listening. This is the Badger Sports Network from Learfield.
Badger basketball has been brought to you by Alliant Energy. Alliant Energy is powering beyond for you. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Ho-Chunk Gaming Madison and Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin Dells. Proud casino partners of Wisconsin Athletics. And by Fabic Rents. For all your equipment rental needs throughout Badgerland. The preceding has been a Learfield presentation of the Badger Sports Network.
Do not follow the dictates, the mandates of the president's directives when it comes to immigration policy. Lots of things, lots of very troubling things coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice that are also not completely unprecedented in terms of directives, but certainly contrary to the movement generally of the Department of Justice in recent years under all administrations, Republican and Democrat. We're also going to be talking, of course, about the Supreme Court and the things it did just this past week. All of that coming up on this edition of Amicus, a Law Review. Stay with us for that discussion.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
There's danger out there. It lurks on highways and quiet.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus Law Review, our weekly weekend review of all things government, justice-related, court-related, prosecution-related, rule of law-related. Thank you for joining me this weekend for a discussion of many dizzying things coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice, coming out of the White House, coming out of Washington, D.C., including our United States Supreme Court just this past week. We will also talk, of course, about some of the, at least a couple, of the oral arguments conducted by the Supreme Court just this past week, one of those having to do with excessive force and the mechanisms under which judges assess the propriety or impropriety of police in the marketplace. We'll also talk about some other cases pending in front of the Supreme Court, including one involving a money laundering statute, its revival, its effective resurrection of a money laundering statute that just happening this past week. Lots and lots of things to get to, including, as I promised initially, resumption of our discussion about guardrails and standards, those kinds of things that we should be able to rely upon in terms of institutional limitations and conditions, restrictions and checks on the kinds of things that branches of government do. We know well that under the Constitution, this design by James Madison and others, checks and balances across the board between the legislature and the executive branch and the judicial branch. And for the most part, those have worked throughout much, if not all, of our 238 years of existence. Some of that beginning to fray at the edges as we look more and more to things like the Supreme Court's decision of last July, effectively elevating the executive branch above the others in terms of its power and authority and its immunity from prosecution for crimes committed. All of those things implicated not only in the past, but now just this past week, as the current president, under his authority as the executive of our nation, executes the law, as we talked about before, arguably, depending upon your perspective, taking care under the constitutional language that the laws of our government, of our nation, be faithfully executed. All of those issues coming into play in the hours and days after Donald Trump's inauguration, including these many different executive orders. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them focusing upon immigration, ways big and small, all kinds of things that the president is doing in that area and others as well. We'll also talk, of course, about the executive order having to do with birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment. We'll talk about what a federal court judge did just this past week in connection with that attempt to change the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. But before we get to all of that, let's talk about civics. Let's talk about the mechanisms that are out there that ensure that actions of the government generally, including presidents of the United States of America, including executive agencies and authorities, behave in a way that's consistent with the laws and with our Constitution. I have mentioned before that there are over 90, there are actually 93 U.S. attorneys nationwide, also in our territories. There are 94 districts altogether in the United States of America. You can go onto the maps, provided by the Department of Justice, provided by our courts, and see where all of those district courts are. They have together formulate also circuit courts. Those are the places where you go after you're dissatisfied, for example, with a decision by a district court, the trial court judges. Ultimately, from the circuit court, where do you go? Well, you may go to the United States Supreme Court if the Supreme Court decides to hear your case. I'll mention in the second hour that as of this weekend, the Supreme Court in this 2024-2025 term has decided to hear 59 cases altogether up to this point, probably more being added. In the midst of that process in the judicial system, what are the roles of judges? What are the roles of United States attorneys? Let's begin there. United States attorneys, of course, are appointed by presidents. And they, again, according to the Constitution, nominated by the president, subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. Yes, the advice and consent, the approval of a majority of the senators is necessary before a United States attorney in any of those 93 districts can take office. This process also applies, interestingly, somewhat anachronistically, to United States Marshals, who, again, the very first law enforcement agency way back in 1789 in our nation. Our founding fathers thought the United States attorneys, ultimately, the people responsible for putting the laws into effect in these districts, ultimately. But significantly, even before that, the government, the Congress saying U.S. Marshals should also be confirmed by the United States Senate. We saw just on Friday of this week that confirmation process when our incoming Secretary of Defense was confirmed by a narrow majority, a one-vote majority broken by, if you will, the president of the Senate. He is the vice president of the United States of America named J.D. Vance. That same process, that approval process by a majority of senators also applies to United States attorneys. Why? Why? Because those people, while they should be and have been, for the most part, with some notable exceptions, apolitical and nonpartisan, are responsible once again to the people of our nation. Their role is not to be beholden to the president. It's not to be beholden to some other authority, but beholden to the Constitution, to the rules and regulations. And how is that done? That is done by oversight. Absolutely, by an attorney general, by a deputy attorney general, by other people responsible for administering the laws, establishing policy inside the Department of Justice. And so I had the great honor to serve as the United States attorney, initially court appointed in an interim process between two administrations, ultimately presidentially appointed in the administration of Barack Obama. I had the great honor to serve in his administration. More significantly, my boss, Eric Holder, for most of my term as United States Attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, responsible for doing what? Responsible for enforcing the federal criminal and, yes, indeed, the civil laws in the eastern third, approximately, of the state of Wisconsin. The Western District also present here in our state, a separate U.S. attorney located, venued in Madison. I was venued, as I have been recently, all U.S. attorneys in Milwaukee. There's also a branch of the court and a branch of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Green Bay to provide what? Service and support and safety and security for all of the people of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the Western District of Wisconsin, and yes, indeed, the 91 other districts around the nation, including the Northern District of Illinois, the Southern District of Florida, which we've talked about a lot, the District of Massachusetts, the District of Wyoming, districts in California. All of them have U.S. attorneys responsible for implementing in those particular areas the rules and regulations, the laws, the processes of our government. And so one of the things that we have talked about a lot on this broadcast and others of civic media, again, is the responsibility of those U.S. attorneys taking an oath upon Senate confirmation to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. And that's where one of the first guardrails comes in. And we will see in the coming weeks the roles, the actions, the purposes, and the focus of U.S. attorneys now being nominated, ultimately, presumably being confirmed by the United States Senate, the so-called Trump nominees. We'll talk about the Trump nominees. We'll talk about the nominees and the U.S. attorneys who are going to be inhabiting those positions in this time when lots of things are going to be coming out of the White House, their roles and their missions, all of that coming up on Amicus, a Law Review.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
CBS News Brief. President Trump is threatening sanctions and tariffs against Colombia for refusing military planes filled with deportees. ICE also confirms more arrests in Chicago. Democratic Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker on CNN.
We're not going to help federal officials just drag them away because somebody pointed at them and said, oh, that person's brown or that person's not from here. Check it out.
President Trump floated a plan for Palestinians to head to Arab neighbors to clear out Gaza. The BBC's Mike Thompson.
Perhaps most fundamentally, for so many Palestinians, all this will bring back very dark memories of the mass displacement which followed the creation of Israel in 1948.
Criticism of pardoned January 6th rioters from Democratic Congressman Jason Crow.
Well, I don't want to hear Donald Trump or J.D. Vance or anyone else in this administration talk about backing the blue, talk about supporting law enforcement when they just released over 1,000 cop beaters.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks get clipped in L.A. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks began their West Coast trip with a loss to the Clippers last night, 127-117. Giannis Antetokounmpo led Milwaukee with 36 points.
In the fourth quarter, wasn't able to take care of the ball as well. You know, they got momentum, and it was very hard for us to get back to the game. She got to do a better job, you know, next time when we're in that same position, just take care of the ball.
NFL, the NFC and AFC championship games going on. We'll recap them after the games. And is Aaron Rodgers ready to retire? Former Packers linebacker Clay Matthews on the Dan Patrick Show.
Watching him this year, you see those glimpses of, you know, what he has. And I thought for me it was pretty telling when he walked off the field with Devontae with his arm around him. And we remember when he walked off the field with Randall Cobb in Green Bay, what that meant. So we'll see if I'm reading into it too much, just being a fanboy or what's going to happen. But so I'd love to see him.
You think he's going to play one more year?
I think he should play one more year. Do I think he will? I don't know.
That's Clay Matthews with Sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A sunny to mostly sunny sky. Highs today in the lower 20s and southwest winds gusting over 25. Tonight, mostly clear skies. Lows will drop to the upper teens, close to 20 degrees, still breezy. Monday, mid-30s, currently 26 degrees.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Where are you at with dome stadiums?
Oh, love them. Snow games are awesome, but it's also a risk of injuries and everything.
Give me a dome anytime. I don't want to see elite athletes running on snow like it's me playing out there and tripping and slipping. I want to watch those guys run. I want the receivers to run and catch their passes. I want to see great athletes being great athletes.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Pete Hegseth, confirmation hearing.
I've never disparaged women serving in the military.
Except for, you know, the podcast interview in like late November of 2024 when he said women in combat weaken the military. Except for that, Pete, did you get body snatched? Are you not the same guy that sat down in the Brosphere podcast?
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Out here in the middle of these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on earth. That's how it feels when you're struggling with your mental health. But you don't have to feel alone. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
It is the weekend. That means coming up on the show, we'll break down all the news that you might have missed and wrap it up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, as we talk about some civics on our weekend broadcast, providing some context for the responses of our judiciary and, yes, of U.S. attorneys going forward in a time of change, undeniably. Some of it quite dramatic in terms of the way in which we understand our constitutions, our constitution, and the laws of the United States of America. U.S. attorneys, again, these individuals nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, if at all, and responsible then during the term of the presidency for enforcing local laws. And by that, I mean the geographically local laws. The laws they're enforcing are federal laws, but they do that in the local environments in which they are venued. 93 of them throughout the United States of America, including our territories. And so one of the safeguards, one of the conditions upon unfettered action by a president, for example, even by others inside government, is the United States Attorney, the chief federal law enforcement officer for the particular district, responsible for every single day assessing and determining whether or not actions, proposed investigative actions, prosecutorial actions, reviewing decisions to present cases to grand juries, reviewing decisions to open files, which is a very important issue now, making decisions about how the office, the United States Attorney's Office, how other federal agencies who are indeed under his or her oversight as the chief federal law enforcement officer for the district, how are they going to cooperate? How are they going to behave consistent with the laws of our nation? A huge responsibility, and also responsibility once again to you, to ensure that all of that is done in a way that is consistent with the oath of office to support and uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. And so the question comes, when a president, through the Department of Justice, or even worse, directly directs a United States attorney to open an investigation of an individual, for example, for whom there is not a scintilla of evidence, there is not a predicate for opening a file. And yes, indeed, you don't have a probable cause to open a file, but you've got to have some reason to believe that the target of your investigation, even the subject initially of your investigation, may have committed some crime. And absent that, it is inappropriate, it's unethical, it is illegal to open up a file on someone because you do not like them, because they are a political enemy or foe or rival. That is not only inconsistent with our Constitution, but it is contrary to the basic ways in which U.S. attorneys are obliged to work. And so we know in recent times that the president, now in his office in the White House, has threatened to lock up his political foes like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. He has talked about encouraging the Department of Justice and the FBI to go after his rivals, his picks for attorney general. We know her name is Pam Bondi. For FBI director, his name, Kash Patel, have echoed those remarks. Patel's even compiled an enemies list, which includes Christopher Wray, the now recently departed head of the FBI, and retired General Mark Milley. People like that, many others on these lists. What happens if the president calls a United States attorney and asks that United States attorney in a particular district to open an investigation of any of those people without a predicate belief that there has been some criminal conduct? And I should mention as an aside that has also been the practice and the policy for very good reasons to insulate U.S. attorneys from the White House itself. And so all communications, if there are any from a White House to a U.S. attorney, should necessarily be directed through where? Through the U.S. Department of Justice and through the Deputy Attorney General, who would determine what the inquiry is and what the nature of the request or the demand is before sending it on to a U.S. attorney. That's been the process. We will see if that continues. We know that this president already in this week has directed U.S. attorneys to dismiss some of the remaining January 6 cases. Presumably, those are going through the U.S. Department of Justice. But that issue of process is also important here. The larger issue, of course, is what does one do? As a United States attorney required to uphold and defend the Constitution and not open investigations absent there being a reason to do so, what does one do in that circumstances where the boss, the ultimate boss, the president of the United States of America, who has signed off on your appointment as U.S. attorney, and the attorney general also signing off on that certificate of appointment, directs you to open an investigation? What does one do? That's the challenge coming in for U.S. attorneys, if indeed that happens, if indeed people like Pam Bondi and Kash Patel and even the current president make good, or at least try to make good, on their effort to investigate and arguably prosecute people who they do not support. And so one of the safeguards, one of the stopgaps on that is a United States attorney necessarily saying, Department of Justice, people in the Department of Justice, the Deputy Attorney General, and certainly the president himself, one day herself, there is not a basis for doing that. And saying no. That's important, frankly, inside any government office, local, federal, state offices. When you are directed to do something that you know is unconstitutional, the obligation of your oath is to decline to do so. And you've got one of three alternatives. Then you can say, I'm not going to do that. That's not consistent. When you say that, it's highly likely that because you are an at-will employee, U.S. attorneys are not civil servants. I was for about 24, 25 years a civil servant, not subject to firing. But U.S. attorneys are. They are appointees of the president, can be fired at will. And it's highly likely that a president who is dissatisfied with the actions or inactions of a United States attorney could simply say, I am terminating you for cause, not for cause. Those things can be done. Nothing wrong with that process, but it's one of the things that could happen to prevent that safeguard, that guardrail, if you will, from stopping an action by a president. A second thing, of course, that a U.S. attorney can do in addition to saying no, which probably leads to his or her firing, is to decline to do it. And to ensure that that office, the integrity of that office is maintained, it may well be that that U.S. attorney then needs to resign. We think very generally in history about times when U.S. attorneys, in particular an attorney general, remember Elliot Richardson way back in the early 1970s, 1972, 1973, when he was asked by President Richard Nixon directly to direct that the special prosecutor at that time in the Watergate matter be fired. And Elliot Richardson said no. He said, Mr. President, I'm not doing that. There's no basis to do it. And so Elliot Richardson was not terminated. He resigned, as did his deputy attorney general. Ultimately, the associate attorney general, Robert Bork, did what the president said he was requesting to be done. That's the process. But that is one of the safeguards, one of the guardrails along the way. Along the way, one of the things that U.S. attorneys necessarily do is to authorize investigations, including grand jury investigations. We've talked a lot about that other safeguard. These are 23 people called in. They're a branch. They're a unit of the court. And under that system, under our system, grand jurors called in from the public, they're you, they're other people in businesses across the ambit of activity in our nation. They're called in to decide whether there is probable cause to believe that indictments should issue. And I've said on this broadcast and others that my own great respect for and recollection of 30 years of grand jury practice is that grand jurors do not indict ham sandwiches, as is often bandied about, an inappropriate and very flip way of understanding what they do. In fact, they do listen to the evidence, and they are a secondary safeguard, a check against a U.S. attorney, against a Department of Justice, indeed against a president who wants to try to prosecute through an indictment an individual for whom there is no criminal charge
legitimately presented. That's also a safeguard out there. Along the way, during the course of the pre-public investigation, there's also the role, of course, of federal judges. And we began to talk about that last weekend, too. What do federal judges do even before cases are indicted, if at all, by a federal grand jury? Federal judges are also responsible for, in many ways, approving of the pre-indictment investigative conduct and activities of U.S. attorneys and of FBI agents and DEA agents and Postal Service inspectors and all sorts of people out there who are seeking to investigate legitimate crimes. And so, for example, if a federal district court judge is asked to sign off on what we call sort of an eavesdropping warrant under Title III, those kinds of things called a wiretap, he or she will receive an application called an ex parte submission from prosecutors applying for that and establishing probable cause to believe that there's a basis for that, frankly, incredible intrusion into the privacy and security, if you will, of communications. Judges, before investigations, do those kinds of things. And they ask U.S. attorneys and they ask the investigators, what is the basis for our going forward to doing this? And if that probable cause is not there, the federal judges of our nation are obliged by their oaths of office to say no. To say, you know what, I'm not going to give you, Mr. Santel, that application. I'm not going to approve that application. I'm not going to give you that warrant to search a home, to search a telephone, to do some other things that are part of your investigative work, pre-indictment, because there is no basis for doing that. And that certainly would include situations where there is not a clearly identified federal criminal statute that is identified, again, even before the case is indicted, if at all. Judges have huge responsibilities. The one that we sometimes hear about, of course, is the responsibility to review applications for searches of properties, sometimes businesses, sometimes homes. And on a fairly regular basis, when I presented those applications, judges would sometimes say, yes, it is all there. They would sometimes say, no, I don't think, Mr. Santel, you have established here that there is probable cause. Either develop more or the answer will be no. And so there are decisions there that are made pre-indictment during the course of that investigation that are also checks, yes, indeed, upon U.S. attorneys, upon investigators, upon the Department of Justice. And that is done, again, in the interests of America. Along the way, one of the things that U.S. attorneys have the benefit of in that process is that federal judges have generally have a well-founded confidence. The Justice Department, especially in the wake of Watergate and other things, have some sense of confidence that these applications, the requests, have been reviewed at great levels. Most district judges believe that prosecutors appearing before them are acting with integrity, that their offices are not being manipulated to undermine those who may have challenged the current administration or its leader. They have to look at those things, but there's a presumption of legitimacy and of regularity in all of that. A judge can assume that a warrant application has gone through layers of approval within the Justice Department, even reaching in some instances the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division. That's an extremely high-ranking official inside the department. That judge could also be reasonably confident that very little, if anything, would be amiss by passing that process through those various approval levels, including senior department officials. The comments, again, by our current president and others about this notion that we may be going after political rivals would fall into the category of undermining those assumptions. And if indeed federal judges, if somehow these applications get beyond U.S. attorneys and go to federal judges now have responsibility, as they have always had, but especially now, to check to make sure that the reason for the investigation, for the prosecution is legitimate, that there is a there, that there is a federal statute or a series of statutes that have arguably, maybe, been broken and that justify warrant applications, the judges granting those orders to search homes, to search telephones, electronic devices, to establish Title III listening mechanisms, those kinds of things. All of that is also the appropriate role of federal judges. Many other ways in which judges, even before cases are indicted by a grand jury, if at all, are responsible for ensuring the legitimacy of what's going on. And even in the wake, if somehow beyond a U.S. attorney check, beyond an initial pre-indictment investigative check, somehow a grand jury issues indictments and goes ahead with a prosecution proposed by the Department of Justice, judges plainly in the post-indictment period also have an obligation to do what? To ensure that the process includes due process and equal protection, all those things we talk about inside the Constitution. They will entertain motions to dismiss, motions to challenge the search warrants that they themselves may have authorized. We'll talk more about the roles post-indictment of judges and talk about the importance of this process as we go forward under the brand new Trump administration and the safeguards that are inside the department, inside the judicial branch, here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. On Monday, January 20th, Donald Trump returned to office, sworn in as the 47th president of the United States. Right out of the gate, he took a number of actions on his top issue, immigration. Perhaps the most troubling of these is one aiming to end birthright citizenship in America. An immigration attorney I talked to told me, "We're going to sit through a lot of BS over the course of the next weeks, months, and years, but this is the big one." My take? This action from the Trump administration is despicable, unconstitutional, and fundamentally anti-American. The day after the order was issued, Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call joined a coalition of 20 states challenging this action in court. This legal battle will be a tremendously important one for all of us to follow.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for the remaining minutes of this first hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Also going into our second hour as we continue not only this extended civics lesson here on our broadcast this weekend, but also begin to talk about the applications of these fundamental principles to the news of this past week, including, yes, indeed, the challenge to Donald Trump's birthright citizenship order, the pardons of both this president and the prior president, things going on inside the Department of Justice involving commitments or lack of commitments to investigate and prosecute state and local authorities, a direct implication of what we've been talking about in terms of guardrails and safety nets when it comes to the conduct of a president of the Department of Justice, of U.S. attorneys, of grand juries, and also, of course, of trial judges, both before indictment and after indictment, after a case has been indicted. If it meets and surpasses all of those thresholds, those checks and balances, and again, even inside the great majority of U.S. attorneys' offices nationwide, there is review, there's analysis of proposed indictments to grand juries. Usually memorandums are written identifying the bases for going ahead, the statutes invoked, the reasons why the facts support the presentation of an indictment to a grand jury. Grand jury, once again, an entity not of the Department of Justice, not of the executive branch, but of the other branch there involved, and that's the judicial branch. And so that process is also a safeguard inside the U.S. Attorney's Office. If somehow all of these cases go forward after having gotten a supervisory review, U.S. attorney review, grand jury imprimatur, they go before a federal district court judge in the public domain. Judges there, again, have great authority to do all kinds of things, to check, frankly, the other branch of government, the executive branch, as it goes ahead. And that includes entertaining, maybe granting, most often not granting, but on a regular basis, at least reviewing challenges to, for example, search warrants that were conducted in the pre-indictment stage. Was this legitimate? Was there probable cause? Was the grand jury process somehow tainted in some way? Was the process by which the search warrant was executed improper, justifying some remedial action by a district court judge? Is the indictment itself legitimate? Not only in terms of its terms does it set forth allegations that are credible under the statute that's invoked, are there reasons why it should be either reduced in size, dismissed entirely? Again, the great majority of those motions presented by legitimate and authorized and appropriate to our system defense attorneys. That is a part of our process to ensure a proper and complete defense of defendants. Along the way, one of the things that can be presented, for example, is a selective prosecution motion alleging that criminal charges were brought for reasons forbidden by the Constitution, not contemplated by all this process. Defendant has the obligation there to prove that he was singled out for prosecution when others who were similarly situated, for example, were not. And the prosecution was therefore based upon an impermissible reason. Could be race, could be religion, could be politics. A selective prosecution motion. We know well, for example, that Hunter Biden brought one of those. His motion to dismiss his gun case on selective prosecution grounds failed. It was not granted. It's a high standard. But those kinds of things can and should be undertaken by judges. They should entertain those motions as they pursue their own oversight of the cases, plainly to trial and to sentencing. And again, at the appellate level, as we've already talked even this weekend, at the appellate court level, the circuit court level, judges have obligations to review what has happened at the lower court levels. Huge amounts of checks and balances out there beyond the White House, beyond the Department of Justice, to ensure that the checks and balances of our system are in place and are properly regarded. All of that, a part of our system. And although it's not a check and balance that comes out of the investigative and prosecution stage and process that we're talking about principally, we saw an example of that. A federal district court judge just this past week in Seattle, looking not at a prosecution coming out of the Department of Justice, but looking rather at one of these many, many executive orders issued by the President of the United States of America. This one having to do, you know it well, it's the 14th Amendment. Basically, the President announcing by virtue of his pen, one of several orders issued in, again, the opening days of his presidency, that the 14th Amendment, at least the first sentence of it, no longer means what it says and says what it means, declaring that children born in the United States to undocumented immigrants after February 19th would no longer be treated as citizens. The order also extends to babies born to mothers who are in the country legally but temporarily, such as tourists, university students, or temporary workers if the father is a non-citizen. Basically, this is the birthright citizenship attack. This is the attempt to change the Constitution. And indeed, immediately after the president executed that, a federal judge, another branch of government, entertained an action by a number of different attorneys general, many lawsuits across the country, which continue to this day, attacking that executive order. And the judge's name is a federal district court judge in Washington, Washington State. His name is John Cohenour, C-O-U-G-H-E-N-O-U-R. He looked at this, and in 25 minutes, he said this is blatantly unconstitutional. He said, frankly, challenging the lawyers now in the Department of Justice who are seeking to enforce what the president had done, he said, I have difficulty understanding how a member of the bar would state unequivocally that this is a constitutional order. It just boggles my mind. That's the federal district court judge in the check and balance on what the president attempted to do. Yes, it's one, but one of the many orders that are out there now representing the Department of Justice, again, on the other side, inside the Trump Department of Justice. The lawyer for the federal government said the administration's order on birthright citizenship is absolutely constitutional. He argued that undocumented immigrants, get this, remain subject to foreign powers and therefore have no allegiance to the United States, nor the government, argued in the filing, would their American-born children. And that's the basis, using that jurisdictional language in the 14th Amendment, the president attempting to undermine the clear language of the 14th Amendment, a federal district court judge exercising his assigned responsibility, another branch of government, another guardrail, another standard to ensure that the other branch of government does not get out beyond its skis, does not do something that's unconstitutional. The judge entering what is called an injunctive order. It will last for 2 weeks. And then he will have a broader hearing on this. Again, the injunctive order seeking immediate stay on the execution of this particular executive order that would have had huge implications, not just for the understanding of our Constitution, but for legitimate people in the United States of America, including children. We'll talk more about those guardrails, those standards, those applications of our...
Locally grown radio, WFHR. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome comedian and founder of Chip's Money Tips, Chip Chinnery, and filmmaker Nathan Deming, who is touring Wisconsin to promote his film February. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information. And WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. President Trump vowed massive tariffs and sanctions against Colombia for refusing two military planes from the U.S. filled with undocumented migrants. The U.S. is Colombia's biggest trade partner. Another country may serve as a workaround to receive migrants, immigration reporter Camilo Montoya Galvez.
This would be a so-called safe third country asylum agreement that would empower U.S. immigration officials to deport non-Salvadorian migrants to El Salvador with instructions to seek asylum there and not in the U.S.
ICE confirms more arrests today in Chicago. So-called border czar Tom Homan on ABC.
If you're in the country illegally, you're on the table because it's not okay to, you know,